You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to, on Radio Albion, the Orthodox Nationalist. Today's date, this is being recorded on the 20th of April, 2024, and we are in the midst of Lent. And because this is Lent, I ask for assistance from my readers and listeners. I know that for so many of you, you can't do what I do for a whole bunch of reasons. You can't be active. You have so much right. You know, you can't afford to lose a job or to be murdered or, you know, because that could happen without a problem. You don't want to spend the rest of your life in court or whatever. And to a certain extent, of course, that's acceptable, especially when you have little kids. But the one thing you can do is support people who are doing it. And these days, after 30 years of this, I've been doing this since there's been an internet, I've established myself. And establishing myself really has a lot to do with you keeping me functional and keeping me on the air. So I don't remember if where I was. I don't know if I was reading something or if I was on a website, but some of you know, back in 2018, maybe 2019, if you go back to my archives, you'll see that I did something on the Kabbalistic idea of Adam Kadmon as the manifestation of Antichrist. To the extent, I mean, Adam Kadmon, of course, is not a literal person, but it is the new man that, in fact, may be the way that Antichrist presents himself. I just don't think it's going to be that obvious, as the Protestants seem to think. And because I read Kabbalah, you know, from Zohar, etc., which is not easy. There's a lot of simplifications of it out there. It is, you know, the dominant intellectual Jewish way of viewing the world. It's not a fringe by any means. It's taken over Hollywood and all that. But as far as the identity of what Antichrist actually is, and the concept of Adam Kadmon, of course, he's depicted as a person, is the new man, is the primal man, as well as the man that Jewish control will create. It's Antichrist in all but personality. So I'm reading something, and I come across an ad. It may have been YouTube, come to think of it. And it said, Antichrist is here. Come listen to me. I'll tell you all about Adam Kadmon. And my stomach sank. There is exactly one place on this planet that anyone talking like me is going to get the idea of Adam Kadmon from. And that's me. I don't remember. I couldn't look at it. I couldn't look at it anymore. I just saw it. I glanced over it. I saw the name. And I went on. And I kind of blocked it out for as long as I could. Because you know it can't be very good. They were not Orthodox. But someone must have told them about this. I've written about it elsewhere. And, you know, this is why I think people like Michael Hoffman get angry. So I redid a lot of my work in that regard. Because we're at some of the more intense parts of Lent, talking about Antichrist, talking about the end times, and what I, over the decades, have put together, using patristic and philosophical sources, among many others, as to what form Antichrist may take. It seems very odd to me that with the snake-like way the forces of evil and the regime functions, that they're actually going to put an actual literal individual up there with superhuman powers, and no one's going to notice that it's Antichrist. Now, we could never bet on the intelligence of people, but that doctrine is so deep, almost in the popular culture, that I can't imagine they would be so crude. When I say they, I mean the regime, Jewish and otherwise, as to pull something like that. I think it's a little bit more nuanced. And I think the key element is in the Kabbalah. And that is the new man. You know, most revolutionaries from Britain on up have referred to the new man that the revolution is going to create. French Revolution did it especially, and the Soviets more than anyone else. And of course today, the last 50 years, the leftist revolution in the Western world, which we're in the middle of. If these aren't the end times, then the end times is false teaching. Because the ancients didn't have a way of expressing this kind of thing in the language that they had. So years ago, when I first put this together, things were bad, but nothing like it is today. I mentioned that the court system is near collapse because there's so many cases. The court system designed in the early years of the American Republic is not designed for so many people, so many foreigners, and this kind of mass society capitalism. At any given time, there's something like 20 million cases in the court system. I went on and on. There are 1,000% more sex crimes in the U.S. than anywhere else. A handful of people controlling half the globe's wealth. 44 million Americans reading at a fourth grade level. The explosion of mental illness. Mental patients taking up about half the American healthcare budget. 90% of the population on some kind of drug, legal or illegal. Something like 60,000, usually white males, take their lives each year. Police budgets are getting slashed as the country is actually invaded. The budget is getting trimmed, except the Justice Department, who back in 2018, 2019, so its budget increased by over 900% and more. Right, really, I should say from 2003 to 2013, about 1,000%. I said that there's been a 70% increase in teen prostitution since 2003. I think that was before OnlyFans, which I learned about fairly recently, and of course was not even a little bit surprised by it. Now, prostitution is universal and institutionalized. The economy has long bottomed out, but given the nature of the media, most people won't even realize. Most people don't give a damn about their jobs. Only a tiny percent of the American population could serve in the military. Massive increases, usually about average 25% food, shelter, medicine. Massive increases since the lockdown. But those basic prices have gone up 200% from the early 80s to the late 90s. 90% of the layoffs since 1978 have been male, usually white males. And as of a few years ago, there were 21,500 armed criminal gangs in the U.S. as metropolitan police departments are slashed and are not allowed to do their job. And then the migrant invasion. I could go on. But everything that the average educated American, the normie American, believes about the world is a story, is a myth. The rise of materialism, nominalism, liberalism, secularism, industrialization leads to desacralization. No one even knows how to ask the right questions, let alone come up with the right answers. Sodom and Gomorrah were paragons of virtue by comparison to where we live. Now, I say that the fathers, writing many centuries ago, didn't have the vocabulary, and they didn't. to talk about, you know, how could they, what would they think of OnlyFans? You know, that. But let me quote St. Nepheon of Constantinople, 15th century. He said, "And they will be rewarded for the fact that in those days there will be no one in their eyes who could perform miracles, and people from themselves will take the zeal and fear of God in their hearts. And for that time, hierarchy's rank will not be understood and will not love wisdom or reason. They will only care about self-interest. Similar to them, monks will be from possession of large estates, from their vainglory, their soulful eyes are darkened, that they are in disregard of them, that love God with all their heart, and the love of money will reign with all their might. Woe to the monks who love gold, they will not see the face of God. The black hoarders, the greedy, their prayer will not be accepted. And fasting without benefit, offering the sacrifice to God, and all their alms, all are imputed to them in abomination and desecration." Now, that kind of talk is so common, it really falls on deaf ears. It was extremely radical to talk like that at the time, though. The lovers of gold, well, people, I said this before I heard of the Great Reset, that in the last times, no one will own anything. But of course, that's the ultimate goal. As far as monasticism is concerned, there are very few monks, let alone bad ones. Few understand what anything in religion or theology is. Monasticism is just cult-like to them. And happiness and money are equated, no matter how loudly people deny it. St. Anthony the Great said in the 350s, "The time will come when the monks leave the desert. It will flow for them to rich cities, where instead of these desert caves and narrow cells, erect proud buildings. They can argue with the chambers of kings. Instead of poverty, the love of gathering wealth. Humility replaced by pride. Many will be proud. Proud of knowledge, but naked, alien to good deeds. Corresponding to knowledge, love will grow cold. Instead of abstinence, gluttony. Many of them will care for luxurious dishes, no less than the laity, from whom the monks will not differ in any way, the dress. Despite living among the laity, they will call themselves secluded." I like this notion of the proud buildings that will argue with the chambers of kings. Many of you know exactly what that means. That there will be a corporate sector, bankers, usurers, etc., that are equal and now exceeding the power of the state, royal or otherwise. Of course, he's also predicting the auto demolition of the church. Clergy today, such as they are, aren't really knowledgeable in anything, let alone medieval history, which is the font of the church in general. But they live in fear of being called racist on the internet. Now, St. Seraphim Veritsky, who I've quoted before, who died in 1949, he said, "It will be so hard, so bad, so terrible that God forbid to live up to this time." Of course, he's talking about our time. "There will come a time that will not be persecution, and the money and delights of the world will turn people away from God, and many more souls will die than during open hostility. On the one hand, they'll erect crosses and gilded domes, and on the other, there will come a kingdom of lies and evil. The true church will always be persecuted, and it will be possible to be saved only by sorrows and illness. Persecution will be taken by the most sophisticated, unpredictable nature. It will be terrible to live up in these times." Now, he died in 1949, but even then, he was far and away, you know, probably unable to understand, in the language of his day in Russia, the sort of life we're forced to live here. He already predicted the use of psychology, and of course it existed in the Soviet Union in rudimentary form, but psychology is the method of torture and control. He saw kind of dimly the use of the media to control the very meanings of terms, the language, social life. So you did have some dim, very rudimentary understanding of what even we would have a tough time describing to anybody. The ancients couldn't really describe what we deal with. They didn't have the language to describe it. Now, as far as the end is concerned, you know, Protestants have ruined a lot of that talk in the Western world because they've been screaming that the end is coming every year or so. They have no access to the Fathers, so they impose their highly limited interpretation of what they think the Bible is. And entire sects, some quite wealthy, have sprung up on these very human and limited conjectures about the end times. And Orthodoxy tended not to speak of it very much until the 20th century. Now, it's difficult, and it'll be difficult for me, to link the Kabbalah to symbolism, to the nature of Jewish control, the end times, of course, Adam Kadmon himself, and the pagan tradition from which the arcana comes. The regime lives to a great extent by symbols, less so than in the past, because there's no reason for them to hide at this point. You know, symbols like the rose breaking through the frozen earth, that is to say, those who resist the regime. The resurrection of the vertical doesn't necessarily mean that the resurrection of the vertical will lead to monarchy. We're the enemy. We're the frozen earth. In the Arcana, quite often, the enemy is Saturn, which really is the rule of the church, the rule of natural law. You have things like sulfur, the principle of form, with a capital F. Fire associated with Osiris, the intellect, the sun, usually a very positive thing, connected to fire. But like gold, it could represent one of two things, either the new man that we're talking about here, or the rational person coming out of a natural community. The golden man, represented by Horus, that's kind of what we're talking about here. And the occult, and then there's some, you know, legitimate metaphysics here, that the one is ineffable. That one gives birth to form, and in turn, form gives birth to the sun. That is to say, the sun of the universe. Now, the one ineffable creating form or logos, that's quite legitimate. But prior to Christianity, that's how the idea of the sun or actual solar, you know, how it was understood. Reality becoming visible, unconcealed. That this ineffable one, what we consider God the Father, the ancients considered the crown of divine chaos, largely because it was beyond conceptualization. The Egyptians saw it vaguely as the eye of the serpent, not the ultimate cause of unity, because it's beyond such terms. But the one with the capital O was the very principle and foundation of it. The other thing I have to connect is something I got from Michael Hoffman that I really run with over the decades. The Egyptian god Set is one of the manifestations of Satan, the destroyer. He was termed in ancient Egypt, you know, different times and places there. The man, as Wolfgang Heck's translation in 1967, he who was pleased with destruction. Set, that's not just in the satanic worldview, but there is reason to believe the dog star Sirius, Set is a manifestation of the satanic principle, as was Prometheus. Set sometimes, depending on, you know, different periods in Egyptian history, was the creator in the sense of the demiurge, an early presence in the formation of the world. But then, a bit later, he became the principle of the desert, or of infertility. And then, the role of Dionysius, the principle of vice, the creator of confusion. It's the same as a chimera, the Baphomet, the master of confusion, one who disturbs the order of creation, breaking the conceptual boundaries between, say, species or sexes or ideas. In other words, beyond good and evil. To know a little bit, but I don't claim any expertise in ancient Egyptian stuff. Symbolism, on the other hand, has been a concern for a long time. You do have legitimate metaphysical principles, like, for example, Ptah, who brought about form by the word, you know, form through words impressed into pre-existing matter. Atum is the bringing forth the idea of completion, the result of so-called divine manifestations. Toph and Tefnut, the children of Ptah and Atum. The latter is order, Mat is justice and life, manifestation of Tefnut. Some of these have, or just simply poetic, like most of the gods were, poetic understandings of much deeper principles. there is some, not much, but some connection between ancient Israel and ancient Egypt and ancient Greece. The idea of nature as the organized cosmos, the cosmos with a capital C as the ideal arrangement of things, the interplay of limit and the unlimited, which you see in Plato's Philebus, which really creates objects. But Horus and Set are the same as cosmos and chaos. Two pillars, by the way, of the Kabbalah, and the attempt to reconcile those two. You know, the rose, like the rose in the Rosicrucian ideology, Set breaks through the frozen earth and constructs the world according to himself. The principle of distortion, his name really means to separate, fragmentation. It's interesting that the Turin Papyrus has Set called the evil day, a day where there is no giving birth or fruit on the trees. Something along the lines of sexuality not brought to fruition, things outside of their normal boundaries. And if we have time, we'll get into St. Gregory of Nyssa's understanding of this stuff in a little bit. And the fact that he's a foreigner, he's a foreign god representing everything foreign, is significant. Now, some may say that Set killed Apep, the manifestation of chaos, and the creation story, not really a creation story, the organization story, where Atum sits on the primordial mound, surrounded by what the Kabbalah will call the Ein Sof. At the same time, Heka, the goddess of magic, Apep, is found in the waters, that is to say, the chaos preceding creation. Even before prime matter, magic is the words of Atum spoken at creation itself. Form and chaos are meant here to exist together as equals. But killing of Apep, the manifestation of chaos, is not always given to Set. That would go against his later development as a satanic principle. Sometimes it's Isis or Sekhmet doing this, or Mav, one of the many cat gods and goddesses of the pantheon, tearing him to pieces. Of course, the temple of Set, the satanic group, headquartered the U.S. military, of course, under, I don't even know if he's still alive, Aquino, his PhD in political science, of all things. But Set is the demonic principle. In the Osiris myth, the foundational myth of all ancient Egypt, Set is a usurper. He murdered his own brother, Osiris, and his sister and wife, Isis, reassembled his corpse, resurrected her dead brother, / husband. And it was a long enough reanimation so that Horus can be conceived. And so much of the conflict was between Horus and Set. And he was seen as a demonic character. And he wasn't just the god of foreigners, he was a god of violent foreigners. Set killed Osiris, hacking his body to pieces. The Greeks would eventually associate Set with Typhon and even a perverted understanding of Yahweh, a monstrous evil force, raging, not cosmic force, but a force like an avalanche. Set and Typhon were both essentially titans, the deities representing Earth, like Gaia and Geb, who then went after the spiritual side of things, Osiris and Zeus. Not too dissimilar to the titans, which are, of course, earthly rulers, coming directly from Prometheus. Set is the satanic principle who the ancients understood had his seat at the dog star Sirius, the double. He is the father of Anubis. And he is, and this is extremely important, had connections with the Mesopotamian goddess Astarte, which is very important if we want to bring together his satanic connections. Also was the consort of Baal from the Old Testament. But the connection to the goddess Astarte, one of the patron goddesses of Tyre, Ezekiel, Isaiah, both dealt with that cult, the cult of the rich, the sea-bearing, usurious, trade-based economies. Even that the flames of the human sacrifice are, in fact, Astarte. Tammuz, her consort, depicted as being surrounded by their dead children. Depending on who you read, she could be the sister of Baal, cunning, dangerous, a very much like Mercury, and Set is actually connected with Mercury. She's both the goddess of war and the goddess of, like Venus, the goddess of sexuality. She's the master of the horse and the chariot. She's also a prostitute, the goddess of fornication. Astarte used her beauty to control men. So she may be depicted in a military way. She was depicted even on the chariot being naked, which doesn't make any sense, but it was to put forth what she really was. In fact, the Tree of Life, that is the structure of the world from the Kabbalah, grows from her vagina. Now, fallen Israelites saw her as Yahweh's consort, as I already mentioned, allied with Set in Egypt. So any worship of her or anything like this would defile the land and it would have to be abandoned. The apocalypse, I've talked about this before, both in the books of Isaiah and Ezekiel. The Israelites there come to reject God, given their suffering. So magic takes over from natural law. Jews in captivity, that's the origin here, and eventually leading to the small group making its way to Turkish areas and the mass conversion of Khazaria. You have things like Gog, or the Invisible Empire, Egypt, and Set, the crocodile, where the rich see the state as their private property. Adultery, the whore, prophet, that is to say usury, are all one and the same. But Set or Seth was identified in one way or another with Baal as well as Astarte. And the sea, of course. Needless to say, Astarte is the goddess of feminism. So all of these demonic presences in the ancient world are connected. Now, from that, we connect the structure of the world that the Jewish supremacists see in the Kabbalah, where Adam Cameron can be found, at least in one form. Now remember, there really is no God in any of these systems. There may be philosophic principles at the most, but Adam Cameron, at least at some level, deals with states of consciousness, or how the world is perceived. The Tree of Life, and you see the graphic that we use for this this episode, is a depiction of the Tree of Life coming out of the vagina of Astarte, are inhabited by the emanations of the Ein Sof, which is not God, it is the flux, chaos that has yet to be made into anything. And it's the elite who force their will on it. The Jews, followers of the Kabbalah, collectively through revolution, bring themselves about as rulers and hence become God. These are the aspects of Adam. In fact, the Sephiroth, or the emanations from the Ein Sof, create the structure of the world, or the world that needs to be brought about, and the primal man, as well as the new man of the new age, the end times, is Adam Cadman. And it forms the intellectual edifice of Jewish control. Now, I want to briefly go through them. Normally, there's 10. Sometimes in groups, like Keter's is the first one. It's raw power. It still has the chaos of the Ein Sof, which really isn't anything. The Ein Sof is, in fact, simply the nothing. It contains potential. I don't even know how it contains potential for content, but it doesn't contain anything itself. Sometimes it's called the hidden light. It's not a form either. But somehow it has the power drive to manifest itself. Remember, none of this is actually about God. These things are about wealthy Jews considering themselves as God. There's a world they want to bring into being. Keter is this initial will beyond conscious intellect. And the next three, Chokma Bina, and dot dot has its own reality, are three levels of not the divine intellect, because there is no divine here, but the expression of this initial drive, the expression of this nothing that the flux is, very much like in Nietzsche, the flux has meaning carved out of it. The dot represents Keter in its knowable way, knowable form, will and knowledge and dialectical relation. And everything else after that, these are both primary and secondary ways of aspects of a new view of the world. Reality, science, existence, ethics, and action. They mixed, you know, on the left side of the graphic, they're feminine. The feminine principle in Kabbalah is the receptive that nurtures and gives birth to what comes below. And the male, of course, on the right side. We're talking about Jews here. They talk about the soul. It's only the Jewish soul. The Kabbalah sees the Jewish soul mirroring this structure. Creation as reflecting the life source. They're the only divine people, so this is their spiritual life, understanding their own psychological processes. This is how they've come to understand the world. Scientific revolution was about remaking the entire universe. Relationship between elite Jewry and itself, its own idealized conception. That each level here is of the Sephirah, there's a hidden force which is connected to an aspect of human experience. So the second is Chokma, the first presence of the conscious intellect. Keter is just empty power, expression of the end self. Bina gives it some shape, which is the third, the mother of form, the third move, the intuitive understanding. Some people called it, in some of the old books, a palace of mirrors, reflecting and multiplying from form to content, multiplicity. It's the manifold content, as Kant would say, given shape at this level. It's feminine, so it's a womb that gives birth to the new world as the Jews have come to understand it and create it. We talked about this with Moses Hess a few weeks ago. We're already on a stage of deductive reasoning, one idea taken from another, with axioms that are already accepted as true. Bina is a rational process. It's something that the Jews work out to develop an idea fully. It is the scientific revolution. In other words, raw power is taken by the intellect and a world is created from it. This is the purpose of Kabbalah at this level. It's the recreation of the universe. The fourth is Chesed, the visible form. It's mercy in the Masonic cult. See, the first three were epistemological, the world order Jews would like to create. Chesed is the first based on human action. It injects Jewish life into the world. It flows from the recreation of the universe. Justice, for the first time, shows up as their mechanism of control, their unlimited benevolence. Any reference to God is about them or is about Adam Kadmon as the creation of all of this. The fifth is Gevurah, also having something to do with action. This is creative destruction, the ethics of the warrior. I think it is closely connected with Astarte, as we mentioned. It's one thing to have an idea. It's another to make it real and force it on people. Then Tiferet, the balance, the sixth one. It's a force that integrates everything else that we've talked about. Chesed is kindness, gevurah, strength, and judgment. Those are the two pillars that you see in every Masonic temple. One is expansive. One, you know, gives power. The other receives it and nurtures it. One's male, the other's female. And of course, reconciling them is to eliminate those differences. They have to be balanced. There's different ways of bringing out the same thing. Tiferet has the role of balancing conflicting forces, you know, severity and mercy. You know, Israel as a group of leftist hippies and Israel as a highly ranked military apparatus, high tech and everything else, and both have their role to play in remaking society. The other two that have to be balanced are Netzach and Hod. And by the way, if I'm mispronouncing these, I don't care. I've only read them. The intellect balanced with emotion, male and female. You see this in a lot of Jewish entertainment. Netzach actually is Astarte as well, the ideal woman. But Netzach sits across from Hod. The third group, the what they call the tactical organization of life. These are instruments. It's used for something else. These are ways of importing the new view of the world onto the world, dethroning everything in the Middle Ages. So the first two groups deal with epistemological and ontological categories. That leads to ethics, and now these are how to implement them in reality. Keep in mind that all of these names and symbols and ideas, they sort of create a rational whole. They're very broad, but they're perfectly consistent with materialism. We're not talking about God here. We're talking about a revolutionary party in one form or another of how the Jews view the world. And it's not an accident. The first thing is raw power. The Netzach, this balancing act, chesed or mercy, sometimes has to be presented violently. This is designed to break down the borders, the conceptual reality of the demiurgos, or the he who's created the false world that they have to repair. Tikkun olam is essential here. That's what revolution is supposed to do. Everything from industrialization to Bolshevism, capitalism, globalism, Darwinism. Of course, they weren't Jewish as such, but they served that basic revolutionary order. But Hod could also mean where we may take power, and Gevurah is vengeance. So a National Socialist government could take over somewhere. Anything that doesn't allow the Jews go in full power is blasphemous, and therefore they're oppressed, and revenge is gevurah. Remember, these aren't, you know, chronological movements. These are different moments in understanding the world around you. You need a scientific understanding. You need a sociological understanding in order to do much, in order to have a goal of any social significance. Netzach also can refer to leadership, where Hod is the community, the groups that take action, make things happen. Netzach is on the right side, Hod is on the left. Hod would be the eighth in this list. Let's see, the Hod is a force that breaks down energy into multiplicity, different forms, different fields, different agendas. It is intellect, but Netzach is the power to overcome all barriers and associated with emotion and passion and violence. You need both sides here. You need both sides in balance in order for it to work. And the balance is to be found in Yesod, the foundation of the new world, where the different energies that have been considered so far await expression in the lowest world, the Malkuth of the kingdom, where truths, according to them, are made real It's the skull where the mask has been torn off. Again, this is strictly from their point of view. Nothing they're really doing here is true or real. It's rationalization for their power and to de-Christianize everything around us. The lowest in the sense of practicality is Malkuth or the kingdom or maybe the state or the world order. This is the world of phenomenon, and it has to be remade from everything we've mentioned already. It has to be remade, or Antichrist cannot arrive. It's our world ruled over by the regime, bringing about the new man or Adam Kadmon. All of this about breaking down barriers, breaking down the old forms and placing the total lack of form, the rejection of logos in their place, or power in its place. The old giving way to the new, that somehow this is in the nature of things, and it certainly is not. Yesod is the form in reality, not conceptually. It's a foundation upon which the regime can come into existence and rule without a problem. It's how the stuff we've already mentioned is transmitted into the daily grind that we're forced to deal with every day. To summarize this whole thing, we're talking about the remaking of the world, both psychologically and scientifically, so as to completely and totally desacralize it. Of course, it's not their creation, but they certainly will take advantage of it and use it for their own purposes, as Moses has said. Yesod channels all of this and actually creates institutions. And they associate it, of course, with sexuality. Yesod is masculine. It collects all of this ideology of the Sephiroth above and transmits it to the feminine world below. It's receptive for the ideology that's forced upon it. The politicization of sexuality and the sexualization of politics. And this is how this world is able to interact with the Jews as God. It collects and balances. Yes, so it collects and balances the different opposing energies of severity and our judgment on the one hand, mercy on the other, and the Tiferet above it, distributing it throughout the world in science, ethics, and politics, the system of control on a daily level. Malkuth sometimes is referred to as God receiving flesh. The final stages of rule, the ruled creation of Adam Kadmon, associated with the realm of matter and earth, actually the day-to-day, the world of production. Malkuth is the ultimate receiver, and Keith, as we saw in the beginning, is the primary giver. It's one cycle, the march through the institutions, as the regime would say. So, the Kabbalah, the story is that before creation ever existed, everything was light. And the first stage was when the Ein Sof contracted. People couldn't handle light as such. And he created a vacuum to give way for human beings to function, rational beings to function. He created a vacuum, space and time. And the ray of this divine light penetrated the vacuum, and it became Adam Kadmon. It was a projection. The 10 concentric circles emanating from this ray. It's an anthropomorphic form, Adam Kadmon. The realm of infinite divine light without actual vessels or manifestations. But it's also the fullness of all of those manifestations. In the Kabbalah, sometimes Adam Kadmon is referred to as Adam Eliyah, the higher man, or Elyon. Sometimes he's called Adam Harishon, or the primary man, or the primal man, the essence of mankind, or Jewry, as it should be, before the light was broken in this vacuum. Of course, the job of the regime is to collect all of those light fragments from this initial breaking. And that, of course, is revolution. It deals with Jews and Jews only. Sometimes Adam HaKadmoni is referred to as the ancient one. It's both the ultimate divine purpose for creation, that is, mankind under the Antichrist as an embodiment of the Sephiroth I've mentioned above, or the manifestation of all the so-called divine attributes themselves. Adam Kadmon turns out to be both Adam, man himself, and the Ein-Sof. Kadmon meaning primary, being first, but also the fulfillment. Adam Kadmon came into existence before the four worlds in the Kabbalah: emanation, creation, formation, and of course, action, which is reflected in the Sephiroth we've talked about here for the last 10 minutes. Each of the four worlds is represented by one letter of the four-lettered name of God, which we'll mention here in a second. Adam Kadmon is represented by the first letter, Yod. Adam Kadmon, most of the time, will correspond to the first emanation or Keter, as we mentioned above, the divine will that motivated creation, but of course it doesn't end there. Now, the Zohar, as we continue to mention, was something that was put together by Moshe Kudavero. We're not talking about Isaac Luria or the Lurianic, but in the Cordovero version, the Sephiroth, Adam Kadmon, the four worlds, they are chronological from the Ein-Sof. It's a bit more traditional. But Luria, which I think became more dominant, creation is a dynamic process, having to do with the so-called divine exile and the recapitulation of all things. The shattering of the Sephiroth that created the present world at the point of creation. Adam Kadmon is, in fact, preceded by the contraction. The light simply by itself was too much for any one entity to understand, and so they broke apart. The Zohar itself states, quote, "The form of man is the image of everything that is above and below. Therefore did the Holy Ancient select it for his own form." Don't assume that the Holy Ancient here means God. The heavenly man is the embodiment of all what they call divine manifestations. And the ten Sephiroth are the original image of man before the fall. The heavenly Adam, or the Jews in our times, the last times, are recreating Adam himself. So you have the original primal man and all of that being recapitulated at the end times. Then their Messiah can show up. Adam Kadmon became far more important as time went on, especially with Isaac Luria. He wasn't just the manifestation of all of these forces that we talked about, but he was in fact a mediator, an active individual. The Ein-Sof is completely incomprehensible. So even the manifestation of it in the Sephiroth have to be made more human through Adam Kadmon's intervention. Adam Kadmon arose in the way of self-limitation by what, you know, Ein-Sof, what most people will call God, and manifests himself in the Sephiroth that we talked about, this procedure, this method of understanding and then recreating the world, repairing it in a Tikkun Olam sense. Making it more understandable, Adam Kadmon is the new man of revolutionary ideology. This seems metaphysical, but that's how it's presented. It's presented as a nature of things, when in fact this is all pretty practical. Adam Kadmon is created in the vacuum of time and space, where God does not exist. He is the energy, however, of Jewish power, and he repairs the Sephiroth, the revelation of light. So man couldn't handle the light himself in his pure form. So God left. Whatever God they have simply doesn't matter, and they have taken his place as titans. Adam Kadmon is a result of all of these shards of light being retaken and then reinterpreted by what we call the regime today. For them, it's the redemption of creation, the coming of the Messiah. The Demiurge, Yahweh, of course, who they reject. Christ, obviously, they reject. the old way of looking at things. Plato, Aristotle, all the way through to the medievals. These are errors. These are Saturn, the frozen earth, and we have to burst through it. And that's the role of the Jews, of course, using many other people as the centuries go on. In fact, the Egyptian Ptah is the symbol of this recreation. In fact, Adam Kadmon, as a satanic presence, comes into being only when the Ein Sof actually leaves and creates this space, where man, of course, is the only thing that matters, in particular, the Jewish man. The Tetragrammaton, that doesn't mean I am, it means to be. It is the to be. The letters Yod, He, Vav, and He, and back to Yod again. To be is something that doesn't exist, but has to be brought into existence, a global Zion. Yod is the hand or the arm. Osiris, the word, but not, of course, in the sense of logos. He, of course, is the real, the number five. It's negation, almost in a dialectical way. Vav is very important because it's the six. It's the nail, or the hook. Horus, or revolution. Another symbol would be the mace. Going back to the original letter, Yod, that's the restoration. So the first man, the primal man, and the purpose of man, symbolized by gold, of course. And it sometimes is called the pacification of the earth, which implies the military and sexual assault of the Astarte, deity that we mentioned in the beginning. Well, the four letters of God's name, I mentioned already, the four Sephiroth, Chokma, Bina, Tiferet, and Malchut, and the four levels of the soul, life, soul itself, emotion, intellect, and the true self. And many place Adam Kadmon at the highest level of Keter, the divine will to create, which is inherent in Adam Kadmon, is the center of what Keter is, or this raw power. It starts off with the raw power. The tree of life starts off with raw power. Because this isn't necessarily about understanding something. It's about creating something. It's almost a divine plan for everything is concealed in Adam Kadmon. The concealed brain, which you found in that first Sephiroth of the tree of life. So it's paradoxical. On the one hand, you have a created being, Adam, which, of course, they don't believe in, but they use it as a symbol. On the other hand, you have the manifestation of this primordial entity. Kadmon, of course, means the primary. So he's often seen as the archetypal collective soul of the Jews in the kingdom, or the lowest level, the ultimate crown of all creation. Almost like the, as Isaac Luria would say, this divine intermediate, which connects some kind of primordial infinity or the flux, the chaos, with the finite created reality, created, of course, by them. And I know it's very difficult to get all of this stuff into an hour, but trying to connect all of this, you know, there's a book out, Jewish Utopia by Rabbi Michael Hicker, came out in 1922. I found it, I think I've mentioned this already, I found it in a used bookstore many years ago by accident. I didn't realize what I had found. It was a scholarly expression of what Jewish rule was going to be, what Jewish utopia is going to be. And he follows very much my argument that the rabbis are creating a new world. They're not reflecting it, they're creating it, or taking advantage of what's already been created. The Jews themselves are God and collectively are Adam Kadmon. And because of that, they own anything that could be considered wealth. Nothing actually belongs to their enemies. That Zion, Israel, is really profit and power. Wealth belongs to the Jews, as he says on page 2. No dissent is permitted. Death itself, as he says on page 59, will be conquered through eugenics. The Noahide laws, especially that of idol worship, right? A god other than them will be wiped out, as he says on page 39, and even mentions the Trinity as something that will be forcibly removed from consideration. He says that on page 34. He uses a lot of Platonic language I don't want to get into, but this is a far more important book than a lot of people realize. 1922, before National Socialism and everything else, this was what the Jews had in store. You don't read these subliterate, you know, protocols. Michael Higger, of course, is far above that nonsense, where he mentions these things, of course, in pseudo-intellectual language. The state will be a universal one, Zion, and it will be rabbinic, both in a literal and a figurative sense. Any wealth that doesn't have an owner, you know, lost treasure, whatever it will be granted to the Jews. He says that on page 12. And any dissent will be wiped out, but he mentions on page 37, but given a fair trial. I mentioned Gregory of Nyssa and his conception of evil. What the end times are, the reign of this Adam Kadmon concept, the new man, which we see all around us, it's a temporary victory of evil. Evil really can't be victorious. Evil's defined by St. Gregory and the church for millennia, that which resists God, resists being. Evil is the unsown herb, without seed, without root. It's a lack. It's not a thing in and of itself. It's a lack of something. It's a removal of something from its purpose. Asarte is, for example, from reproduction or justice, which are, of course, a creation of the powerful for these people. And children, of course, get in the way, and so they're executed, as his iconography shows. So Gregory says, St. Gregory says, evil is defined as nothingness. It never exists by itself, but only inside or a part of goodness. Evil is a pure negation, a privation, or a mutilation. It's a dejectus, a defect, a lack. But the structure of evil, he says, is rather antinomic. Evil is a void of nothingness, but a void which exists, which swallows and devours things. Evil is powerless in its powerlessness. It never creates, but its destructive energy is enormous. You notice that with the Kabbalah. Evil never ascends, it only descends. Evil is chaotic. It is a separation, a decomposition, constantly in progress, a disorganization of the entire structure of being. But evil is also, without doubt, vigorously organized. Everything in the said domain is deception and illusion. Which is another way of saying, God did not create evil. Free will exists, though. And since you can't compel someone to like you, evil always remains a possibility, the misuse of things. And what I just quoted is the church's entire conception of what evil is. It's not a thing, but it does have an essence of a sort, and that it's a void that destroys being. Being, essence, purpose, light, logos, energy, they're all one and the same concept, seen from different points of view. The activity of the true God on earth, not the Sephiroth, as we mentioned above, which is the imposition of ideology onto the world and calling themselves God. Evil is represented by the end times, Adam Kadmon, as a lack of reality. Demons use images, fantasies. They tempt people into sin with these images. They're not real. They're certainly taken from parts of reality, and they're put together in a way in our own minds, and we do this all the time. It's meant to invert its own purpose. This is why the media is so important for Antichrist and the false prophet. Evil, of course, is destructive. It doesn't create anything. It can't. Images are composite fantasies. They lead people to believe that some satisfaction exists in some perversion, and you've seen the sexual nature of the Kabbalah. That these gods and goddesses we talked about, they can't create anything. They can only rearrange, not just rearrange what's been created, but alter how we perceive what has been created. And, of course, it's also chaotic. The real balance is very delicate. But since creation is contingent, it doesn't have to be. The balance can be upset. But importantly, it's also the separation of the thing from its true essence, meaning, and purpose. It's taking a good thing and using it incorrectly for the wrong reasons. So for St. Augustine, it's just a matter of error. You know, we truly believe that sex and marriage will make us happy. We find out that it's far more work than we expected, and so we suffer. Now, eventually, ideally, that suffering brings us to the knowledge that God and God alone is the only thing worth reaching for. Everything else, due to its contingency and its ability, its amenability to be, it's amenable to be fantasized about, it will eventually bring death and decay. So freedom, we desire a lesser good, and ontology, that nature is not a machine, it's contingent and it can be perverted in certain ways. Again, evil is also illusion and deception. Images aren't real, but they often contain just enough reality to make us think they are. We fantasize about punching someone in the face, which I fantasize about every day, maybe of meeting someone more beautiful, of being wealthy, of being popular, whatever. We go out and we do whatever's necessary to make those real. And of course, none of it is real in the first place. The rich aren't happier than anyone else. They usually have more problems. Punching people might be temporarily satisfying, but it goes nowhere. Contrary to TV, you pursue a more beautiful woman only to find out that they're far worse and far more difficult to deal with than anyone else. Evil ultimately then is taking the image for reality. Appearance is mistaken for the essence of something. And it's a matter of will. We take the appearance of something for reality because we want to. We want this pleasure. We strive for this fantasy image. And it leads to endless problems. And we'll soon die anyway, no matter how lucky we may have been. Knowing evil becomes, understanding this is very important, especially when these things come in the guise of the good. St. Abba of Tbilisi. The end times is a war, as he calls, between red Jews and the church. Set will gather the nations at the Gog and Magog, the mountain of darkness. He says that the cosmos even broke away from Adam Kadmon. Light is there, repair. Isaac Luria. This is not unknown, not that long ago. This is quite literally the nature of the beast. Hero monk Arseny Boka, who died in 1989, he saw this self, this false prophet, the building of the new man, Adam Kadmon, is based on self-promotion. He always knows better. That sort of mentality always knows better. Whether they know anything or not is irrelevant. The ends always justify the means, so the moral disorder, a total lack of attention, lack of any kind of concentration skills, that's the result. And I'll end by quoting St. Arseny Boka. He says this, "I'm sorry that you're so weak in faith that you'll fall out of fear of the devil. And don't be afraid to save your souls. It'll be very difficult in these times. But by God, who is a companion to everyone from birth to death, the elect also will fall. I'm sorry that you're going to be one of the last ones. They will sift you. They will tax you. They will put laws on you. I'm sorry." He lived not that long ago. But he makes it clear that those of us living now, there will at least be an attempt to make us fear. The fear of standing out, the fear of being different, the fear of being alone, the fear of having nothing, including your own freedom. Whatever the regime accuses anyone of doing, you can be certain that they're doing it. This stuff, Adam Kadmon, the Kabbalah, this is a neurotic projection of a group of people who believe themselves to be God, but have rejected Logos, the second person of the Trinity. But who are those people who are not afraid? What are the marks, as the monk Raphael Karelin, who I think is still alive, or if he died, it's very recently. true love of God. You have this desire to pray for others. You thank God for suffering and problems because it makes you see things for what they are, not the fantasy. That the building of wealth is not a good thing. It, at best, it's a necessary evil. We're not self-righteous. We blame ourselves. We see ourselves as the worst of sinners. We seek solitude rather than the company of others. We don't seek justice right now because we know it doesn't exist in the world. And we know Tikkun Olam, the Jewish revolutionary drive to repair the world. To repair the world that Yahweh, who they despise, created. Because they are superior to him. And the magic of technology being just that. Insanity, as the monk Raphael would say, comes from passions. Again, it comes from the false understanding of what we're shown. Power and wealth, even if they're achieved, are illusions. And the self becomes split in two. We want the fantasy, but we're forced to deal with the cognitive dissonance that we know it's not what it is, even if we achieve it. People fear the regime because they think it's all powerful, which, by the way, a violation of the first commandment. Ultimately, pride comes down to rejecting God. As Komiakov would say, the Kushite mentality rules. Colossal buildings and colossal objects. Man is soon seen as a mechanical instrument of fate. That's the true foundation for the rule of Adam Kadmon, the creation of this new man. That's what the tree of life in the Kabbalistic mentality really is talking about. Regardless of the abstract and pseudo-theological form it takes. Thank you, everyone, for listening today, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.